Good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Richard Thompson Ford. He's George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford Law School and has regularly published on topics of civil rights, constitutional law, race relations, anti-discrimination law. We'll be talking about a new book that he has authored that's getting a lot of attention and causing a lot of conversation. The title is The Race Card: How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Farrah Straus and Giroux is the publisher. The book is out now, has been for a few weeks, so if you're interested, you can seek it out at the bookstore or the library and take a look at what he has to say. And basically, in his book, he says this. He says, almost all Americans agree that racism is wrong. Many believe it remains a serious problem that affects many people on a regular basis. However, there's a difficulty here. He says that the social and legal meaning of racism is in a state of crisis. The term, he says, now has no single clear and agreed upon meaning. And as a result, he writes, it's available to describe an increasingly wide range of disparate policies, attitudes, decisions, and social phenomena. This leads to disagreement and confusion. He says self-serving individuals, in order to advance their own ends, can embrace the term racism. And we'll talk more about that and how it happens and generally how it is we think and talk about race here in the United States with our guest. And, of course, questions and comments are welcome. We always say people can come into the conversation and ask questions and state their mind. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many people as possible and keep our program moving along. But certainly we welcome people into the conversation. If you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, you could be listening on the internet across the country. Either way, use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Ford, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Just something that I want to make real clear at right up front here, just to make sure people know where you're coming from. I read this passage out of the introduction where you say, you know, almost all Americans agree racism is wrong. Many people believe it remains a serious problem. You would count yourself among those who would say, yes, it's wrong, and yes, it's a serious problem.
Absolutely, yes.
So no hesitancy about that.
No.
And yet we do seem to have a problem. What is the problem?
Well, when the civil rights laws were first passed, there was a lot of racism that was quite blatant. And so early civil rights activism had some pretty conspicuous targets, Jim Crow laws, blatant segregation, and out-and-out racial discrimination. Employers would admit or have formal policies that excluded blacks or relegated them to the most menial jobs. But now that's no longer true. And so one problem is it's harder to know when racism is in play and when it's not. Everyone has an incentive to downplay or to cover up or to dissemble about it. So we spend a lot of time just trying to figure out whether racism is motivating some behavior or whether some legitimate motivation is motivating it. That's one. Another set of problems is that you can tell a kind of good news, bad news story about today's race relations. On the one hand, the good news, racial attitudes seem to be improving. Not only do we hear much less blatant or explicit racism, but I think it's more than just that people are trying to hide their bigotry. But in fact, each generation is less bigoted than the previous one, and racial attitudes are improving by all reliable sociological measures. So that's the good news. The bad news, though, is that many racial problems remain as severe or almost as severe as they were during the era of blatant race discrimination. The isolation of the black poor is as bad or worse than during the Jim Crow era. poverty in many minority neighborhoods is as bad or worse than in the Jim Crow era. The incarceration, for instance, particularly of young black men, is much worse than in the Jim Crow era. And so there's this sort of disjuncture between improving attitudes on the one hand, but certain racial problems that have not improved and in some cases have even gotten worse. And that leads a lot of people to contest the definition of racism and to assume that if we have these severe racial problems, there must be a bigot to blame for them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as racial attitudes are getting better, plenty of people think, well, that's not plausible. This person's not a bigot. I'm not a bigot. You're just playing the race card, they say. And that kind of social conflict, I think, is at the center of a lot of our discussions about race today.
Yeah. And I think that there's clearly also something else going on, or at least another difficult issue, and it's another of the things that you write about in the book, and that is, as a society, in what way do we address the present day effects of past racism? This is what you call racism without racists.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, please.
You go ahead. I set it up. You can hit it.
Well, right, racism without, absolutely. So one of the reasons that we can tell this good news, bad news story is that the bad news is in many instances the effect of racism in the past. Racial segregation, for instance, which is responsible for any number of other racial ills. It's responsible for the isolation of many African Americans from job opportunities, from networking opportunities. It's responsible for the problem of failing schools in black neighborhoods. It's responsible for high crime rates. That is, by and large, the result of racism in the past. Residential patterns and practices that were set up in the era of explicit discrimination and continue even when there's no bigot today to blame for them. And so how to deal with that type of a problem is a significant legal and policy question. Right now, we don't have a very good way of talking about racial inequities and racial injustices that don't involve a racist right now. And so the tendency is to try to find a bigot to pin to the dartboard. Hurricane Katrina is an example of this. So obviously the victims of Hurricane Katrina were overwhelmingly African American. There was a real problem with bungling of the relief efforts, and also a very significant problem with the under-maintenance of public infrastructure, so the levees failed and people knew that the levees were not equipped to withstand a Katrina-sized hurricane. All of this led some people to make accusations of racism. The Reverend Jesse Jackson compared conditions in the New Orleans Superdome to the hull of a slave ship. And, of course, famously, the rapper Kanye West said, George Bush doesn't care about black people. Now, whatever you think of George Bush's policies, and myself, I take a pretty dim view of many of them, I don't think it's fair to say that he's a racist. There's just no evidence of that. And that kind of accusation really distracts attention away from the real problems, again, maintenance of public infrastructure, support for social programs, including disaster relief, problems with the government response from the federal, state, and local level, that those are the things that we need to look at, and residential segregation, which was responsible for the fact that African Americans disproportionately occupied the low-lying areas in New Orleans and those areas that were worst hit by storm. So that's an example of racism without racist. A real racial inequity, yes, but maybe no bigot to blame for it.
It seems that maybe one of the problems is it's we don't seem in the place that we are now, we don't seem to know exactly how to talk about race, as if we can't acknowledge both that there has been progress and that things are better, and yet there still are problems, and that for some people things haven't changed at all. It seems as if we can't quite find where that mid ground is to talk about race and racism in an honest and sort of realistic way that reflects where it is we are right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. We have a very hard time talking about racial injustices without finding a bigot to blame for them, and that causes two unfortunate consequences. One is, if we can't find the bigot, a lot of people say, well, there's no problem. Mm-hmm. Either it's the fault of the people who are suffering the inequity, they just need to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, but there's no social problem here, or there's no problem, it's just a matter of private choices. That's one on the one side. On the other side, if there's a problem, people insist that there's a bigot and try to blame, you know, the government official or the person nearest to hand and accuse them of bigotry because they're, you know, in charge of a situation where there's a racial inequity. And both of those aren't constructive solutions. So I think you're right. We don't have a good way of talking about race in this contemporary moment where a lot of the inveterate bigotry of the past is waning, and I think waning fairly rapidly. But at the same time, many of the racial injustices are still severe.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus, Richard Thompson Ford. He's professor of law at Stanford. He's published regularly on topics including civil rights and constitutional law and race relations. He's the author of a recently published book, The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's out now in the bookstore. You can certainly go and take a look at it, and questions welcome. We have a couple of people here to talk with and bring into the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller up in line is on a cell phone, and this is our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I have a question regarding the recent election. How do you see Senator Obama and all the, you know, the race issues that came up lately? How do you see that in light of your book?
Oh, interesting question. How do I see the things in the election? Well, this election's been fascinating. I think when it started, a lot of people thought that the country wouldn't support an African American for president. Even after Barack Obama won in Iowa, people talked about something called the Bradley effect, where the idea was that when people were expressing their racial attitudes in public, where others could hear, they were quite progressive about race issues. But in the silence of the voting booth, they would vote their bigotry. And the example was in California, Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley ran for governor, and all the polls showed that he was way ahead, but he actually lost the election. And so people have speculated about this Bradley effect. Well, it turned out the Bradley effect didn't quite happen. And in fact, in other states like Nebraska and in moving on across the country, Barack Obama continued to do quite well. So there is something positive and hopeful that's happened that the Obama campaign has tapped into. I think racial attitudes are getting better. Now, at the same time, we have seen a reemergence of some racial divisions. I think it's extremely tempting for politicians to play the race card when they're in order to get political advantage, and I think we've seen a little bit of that on both sides from the Clinton campaign and in some cases from the Obama campaign. So I think that to some significant extent, politicians can be responsible for sort of whipping up racial divisions that may have been latent or quiet if it hadn't been for the political campaigns.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, one thing that I find interesting, or at least I wonder about, particularly in this much discussed difference between Senators Clinton and Obama in their ability to attract white working class male voters.
Right.
That's where it is said that she's strong and he has a weakness. And one wonders, because a lot has been made, and I think there's been an awful lot of posturing and pandering going on, but a lot has been made also of differences between the two of them in terms of their ability to connect with people of different social class,
right,
which is something we don't like to talk about in this country, but I think it's there, even though we don't like to talk about it. And so one of the things that I wonder is if indeed this is true, if it indeed is that there are these people who, I suppose, they're the Reagan Democrats, they're
right,
blue collar white working class people, if they're reluctant to vote for Senator Obama, does that have anything to do with the fact that he's a person of color, or Is this more of a class kind of thing, and that somehow what they're reacting to or not being able to identify with is some perception that he's an elite snub, and that Senator Clinton is somehow positioning herself better to say, no, really, I'm one of you, and this guy, he's not, and that it's not really so much about race?
Right. It's a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. One thing that's interesting about this recent set of ideas that Obama doesn't appeal to white working class men is, you know, there's a little bit of rhetorical gerrymandering going on here. The first cut was that Obama wouldn't be able to appeal to whites, and now that's clearly not the case. And so the category has been shaved down to become white working class men. Now, even then, I presume that there were a lot of white working class men in states like Nebraska, where Obama did quite well and surprised a lot of people. And that's just one example, but it springs to mind. So, you know, we've even got a narrower demographic than that of the people that it's turned out Obama hasn't appealed to. Is some of it to do with race? I imagine so. But I think you're right to suggest that there are other factors as well. And, you know, it may well be that the kind of charismatic nature of Obama's message just doesn't resonate as well with this group of voters that you're describing, that they're more, you know, bread and butter type voters who really want to know about some specific set of policies. And the more general and inspiring themes of Obama's message haven't gone down as well with them.
Well, we have other callers. We'll come back here to someone where we are in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm a student seeking my elementary education certification, and one of the things that's talked and discussed quite a bit is diversity issues in education. And one of the things I do is I try to educate myself as well as just through taking classes, reading things like Race Matters by Dr. Cornel West or Jonathan Kozol's Savage Inequalities, and many other things. But I've had a few opportunities to volunteer and work at a spread of different schools. For example, a magnet school north of town, and it's kind of that euphemism too, the north side of town, and also working at a private school. And I'm starting to understand. I mean, you go to the magnet school, and yes, they're racially, in theory, balanced, but everywhere you see are Hispanics, African Americans, a minority of whites in the school. You go to the south side of town, and you see predominantly whites. Go into the private school, and it's maybe 3 or 4%, 5% African Americans and minorities. And
yes.
And the idea that David talked about this shifting a little bit into class, but I'm also thinking about the analogy you brought about playing the race card, and I feel like if you continue that, you can say that the front side of the card might have the value of a set of clubs or king of hearts or whatever, but I say you flip over the card, and each one of them has the word race on it. And I'm curious about your thoughts about tacit racism through general community attitudes in education, and thank you.
Well, thanks for your question. I think segregation in public schools is one of the most severe problems that it remains unaddressed as a legacy of, you know, from after the civil rights movement. That's somewhat ironic given that many people would describe the beginning of the modern civil rights revolution as Brown versus Board of Education, a case that most people thought at the time, at least, was about integrating public schools. Now, in last year's Supreme Court case involving schools in Seattle, they held that the 14th Amendment, the same constitutional provision responsible for Brown versus Board of Education, actually prohibits local schools from engaging in voluntary integration plans. So here's an example of the court intervening in a case, you know, in this case, I would say an activist court intervening in order to overturn the results of a popular democratic decision in order to thwart race integration. That's tragic, in my view, and it's one of the things that's going to be in the way of fixing the problems that you're describing. There, even with voluntary integration, there are severe challenges to promoting meaningful race integration in public schools, and I think it's a challenge that, you know, needs to be worked on, and we need to be open to any number of new ideas and experiments. I wouldn't rule anything out in trying to confront this problem, but that, as a consequence of neighborhood segregation, is one of the most severe problems, and if we can't find a way to bring people together and educate them and socialize them in common democratic environments, then I think we're going to find it very difficult to address the social divisions that continue to plague our society.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a parent here in Champaign, and the Champaign Public Schools. I have a child in the Champaign Public Schools. And most of the more affluent white people have gone to private schools, or they move to small towns around like Monticello, Mahomet, St. Joseph that are predominantly white. And also those schools are better. You know, there's less disciplinary problems, less overcrowding. The comment that I want to seek from you is, one of the things that happened here in Champaign was a court consent order with the schools. I don't know if you know about it, on discipline. About a decade ago, a lawsuit was filed, and it was shown that statistically black students were disciplined more frequently or suspended from school. So a court order was entered where the school system is trying to, discipline black students less in a way. And what that's led to is, you know, certain bad apples. I'm not saying all the black students are bad, but the bad bully type people who happen to be black realize that the teacher's hands are kind of tied, you know, shackled. They have to be careful. They can't just discipline them. And so they know they can get away with a lot more. And that just exacerbates the discipline problem, and it leads to even more fleeing of the more affluent, more academically performing students to private schools or elsewhere. So your comment on how solutions to race problems can actually make them worse, unforeseen consequences. Thanks.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I don't know enough about the specifics of the Champaign consent decree to do more than speak generally, but I do think that that kind of thing is one of the real challenges of our contemporary civil rights regime and our dealing with race problems today. It's important to make sure that teachers are not racially biased, and that seem to be the goal of the consent decree. But at the same time, as your question suggests, it's important to make sure that we don't attribute to racial bigotry or bias what is in fact a sensible response to social problems that may well have racially disparate consequences. So if it turns out that the black students are being disciplined more because more black students have discipline problems, then that shouldn't be treated as an instance of racial bigotry. And it sounds like maybe that's what's happened here. Even if that's not what's happened, the fact that students now feel that the teachers' hands are tied and they can get away with anything is a severe problem. And so I think you're right to say that that's an example of a solution that may have had unintended consequences, and it's the kind of thing that we always have to be careful with when trying to devise appropriate remedies. The larger problem in this context is trying to get integrated schools to work, and solutions that drive people out of the public schools and into private schools, or drive people out of the school system and into other neighborhoods, are pretty obviously not good solutions.
Yeah, I just to follow up on the comments of the caller, I'm certainly not probably as well as I should the background for the consent decree. I'm not a parent. I don't have kids in the schools, but I think it's certainly true to say that the lawsuit was initiated because there were people who felt that overall that the public schools were failing the African-American students, and that not only it is true were they disproportionately the subject of discipline, but they also were disproportionately in special education, and that if you looked overall at their academic performance, they were at significant deficits when you compared them to non-minority students, or certainly to white students. And I think that the people who started out this lawsuit and forced this situation on schools were basically saying, look, we have a significant problem here. We are failing our African-American children. And if we don't, you know, this can only work out to the bad for everybody, for
right.
them, for society, and that it's our responsibility as a community, and it's the school's responsibility to try to provide a quality education to all students, no matter who they are, and
yes.
that here is a place, and that they'd say here's a place we're really fallen down in the outcomes here of black students.
Right. And so you're saying the consent decree was about a lot more than discipline.
Yes, it was not just about discipline. It was about the whole picture in terms of all the, you know, the experience and the outcomes and the performance of African-American students.
Right. And, you know, we were seeing in state after state litigation to try to deal with some of these educational inequities, some of which involve race explicitly and some of which just involve class inequities or disparate funding for schools or disparate outcomes, disparate performance levels. But this is something that many, many states are grappling with. And I think, you know, a consent decree is always a pretty blunt instrument. And so a lot of the problem may come from the fact that the courts are doing the best they can, but not particularly well positioned to deal with these quite complicated and systemic problems that involve, you know, disparate resources at home, disparate peer influences in the neighborhood, as well as problems in the school system. And so we need to continue to try to confront these problems, and I wouldn't want anything that I said to suggest that it's better to do nothing, but it is the case that the limited tools that the judiciary has simply aren't sufficient to deal with the problem.
Yeah. I think, though, that it's also true that I, and correct me if I haven't quite got this right, that your feeling about the kind of discussion we have about things like, or at least when we use words like diversity and multiculturalism, that you're not so sure about that.
Well, I'm not so sure about certain elements of it. I think that the idea of diversity has taken on a greater significance than it deserves in the educational context. That's not to say that diversity is not important. I do think diversity is important, but we've used it as sort of a fuzzy buzzword that suggests radical cultural differences between racial groups, and suggests that a big part of the reason that we would want integration is that students from these would come to the school with radically different viewpoints. And that's particularly been true in the college context involving the defense of affirmative action. That's what I write about in my book. I actually think that the old-fashioned idea of race integration is a better rationale for affirmative action and may really be closer to what a lot of colleges and universities really want, but we've been forced to put things in terms of diversity, which has the unfortunate side effect of kind of overemphasizing the cultural differences between students, suggesting that the main reason, for instance, that we want black students on college campus is because the black students will bring some radically different cultural perspective to the classroom, when in many cases that may not be true, and it may not even be the most important thing about integration.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here, and I would like to introduce once again our guest If you've just joined us, Richard Thompson Ford is professor of law at Stanford Law School, has published on topics including civil rights, constitutional law, race relations, and anti-discrimination law, and is the author of a recently published book. The title is The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's out now in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Questions, too, here are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I want to touch on one other of the major themes that you talk about in the book, and we've talked about some of them, and you devote a chapter to each. And this is racism by analogy. There are, I think, a variety of people who would argue that they had experienced discrimination based on who they are, along racial and ethnic lines, gender, age, sexual identity, size, some variety of things, and that sometimes, at least, all of these different kinds of people have tried to make the argument that what we're talking about here is a civil rights issue. They right. have essentially made that drawn parallels, wanted to say that for us, our struggle involving discrimination is like the struggle of African Americans,
right,
as far as discrimination, and that we, you know, and that the same arguments hold. What's the problem with trying to draw the discrimination picture so broadly?
Well, sometimes these analogies are appropriate. I don't want to suggest that they never are, but in a lot of cases, this is an attempt to kind of jump over and avoid a conversation about some severe policy issues. Here's an example. Southwest Airlines had a policy, or has a policy, that they've called their customer of size policy. And it holds that if a passenger is too heavy, too large to fit in a coach class seat and lower the armrests, they will be required to buy two coach class seats. The reasons are in order to avoid a situation where other passengers are too crowded. And in fact, there have been some lawsuits in other instances where people sued an airline because they were smashed against a very obese passenger for a long transcontinental flight. And to make sure that Southwest Airlines can collect, you know, doesn't have to leave empty seats and collect the revenue. Now, we could debate whether this is a wise policy or whether it's a kind policy, but it doesn't seem to me that it's a civil rights issue like making Rosa Parks sit in the back of the bus, which is what some of the activists for the overweight community said. It's like Jim Crow. If it were black people, they would never get away with this. Well, there are a lot of differences. You know, most obviously, this is a condition that has objective consequences. Either Southwest Airlines has to give up revenue for one of its seats, and it's an airline that's operating on relatively slim profit margins, so slim that they can't even afford to hand out peanuts on the airline, or they have to risk an uncomfortable flight for one of their other passengers who may well have a valid complaint against the airline. So Southwest has tried to come up with something to make the situation viable. I don't know whether it's a good policy, and I think most people would be happier if the airlines just made the seats bigger for everybody. But, of course, that would involve higher fares for everybody, and it appears that most people select their flights based on price. So that's the kind of issue that really requires a more nuanced policy analysis than we can get by simply saying it's just like racism. And that's an example that I use in the book of racism by analogy, something that's not playing the race card by analogy. It's a way to avoid the real conversation, and in that sense not appropriate, I think.
All right. We'll go to another caller here, someone in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Professor Ford.
Hi.
Good morning. How do you view the new racist anti-Semitism of anti-Arabism? Arabic is a Semitic language. And as a constitutional scholar, how on the basis of the laws of Nuremberg can the invasion of Iraq possibly be justified? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm afraid international law is not my specialty, so I can't address the question about the invasion of Iraq. I have a lot of views about the wisdom of this war, and I don't think it's a wise war, and I wish we hadn't gotten involved in it. But you know, in terms of the legality of the invasion, I'm afraid I'm a little bit out of my depth. Anti-Semitism and anti-Arabism. I think anti-Arabism and discrimination against Muslims is a serious problem for society right now, and it needs to be confronted with all of the vigor that we confront any other form of invidious discrimination. I mean, that's a case that I don't think is an inappropriate analogy to the civil rights movement. I think it's an appropriate analogy, and we need to treat it in the same way that we treat any other form of discrimination on the basis of race or religion.
What do you about, though, a lot of people certainly have raised concerns about profiling.
Right.
As affecting various different kind of populations. How big a problem do you think that is?
Well, I think the debate about profiling has gotten off the rails in large part because we don't have a very good definition of what profiling is. It's interesting. Just a couple days ago, the Los Angeles Police Department submitted a report that found that out of, I think, 320 accusations of profiling, not a single one had merit. None of them revealed racial profiling, according to the police department. The police commission was incredulous. Now, I actually think it's entirely plausible that there was no profiling in any of those cases, given the definition of profiling, which was, did the police stop someone solely because of their race? Now, if that's the question, I think that probably almost never happens, stopping someone solely because of their race. And that's, in fact, the way law enforcement typically defines profiling. It's the way Norm Mineta defined profiling when he talked about the Department of Transportation's policies. And stopping someone solely because of their race or their religion. But do they stop people because of their race or their religion and other factors, things like age, grooming, demeanor, context, sex? Then I think yes, that happens quite a lot. Now, the question then is whether or not that's ever justified. And we have a fight about profiling in which the definition kind of shifts. So if you ask, for instance, the ACLU, they'll say profiling is any use of race. If you ask the police departments, they'll say profiling is stopping someone solely because of their race. So everyone can agree that profiling is wrong, but they've got a radically definition of what counts as profiling. To get to the profiling where race is a factor, among other things, I think you've actually got a tough balancing question about, on the one hand, the undoubted effect of profiling on innocent people who belong to the group. If the police profile on the basis of race and other factors, lots of innocent African Americans get stopped by police, and that's a social cost, and it needs to be taken seriously. On the other hand, the benefits, if the profile is accurate, if there's good information that the risk or the crime is, in fact, disproportionately represented in a particular racial group, then you've got to ask whether or not we can afford to ignore that information and force law enforcement to ignore it. And, you know, I think that's a balancing question that's got to be asked rather than something that's unilaterally condemned.
Mm. We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Richard Thompson Ford. He's professor of law at Stanford Law School. His most recent book is The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse, published by Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux. We have certainly time for other callers. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling on a cell phone in Ogden, Illinois. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Another interesting show. Just a couple of quick comments and a question, and I'll go ahead and ring off. They've got a situation in Chicago schools presently. I think since the school year, something like 20 or 22 or something like that students have been murdered. And your guest's comment a while ago about Jesse Jackson and Katrina, I think, are well taken. I think it'd be very refreshing to have the Jesse Jacksons and the Al Sharptons come up against this obvious tragedy. And I think the reason they might be quiet is because overwhelmingly it's black-on-black crime. And if we're talking about race, and we want everyone to do well in school, because that's only going to help us, a non-racial factor, and I was wondering if your guests could comment on it, would be the marker for the disintegration of the family. And if you take a child from a broken home or a single parent, inordinately that child is going to do worse in school, be a discipline problem, and probably drop out. And I think we're looking at a factor now, if I'm not mistaken, where there might be more black males in prison than there are graduating from college. So race aside, I was wondering if your guests thought that the breakup of the family, a single-parent family, if that, in fact, might not be a big marker for success or failure in school system. I'll go ahead and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Well, thanks for your question. And yeah, I think that the sociological factors, the breakup of the family, and the peer influences in some poor neighborhoods that are isolated from the mainstream economy, are both real factors in the performance of kids in school. And that the question is, what can we do about it through public policy? I think we need to have public policies in order to try to promote more stable families, but that's something that's very difficult to do, and most people have had a hard time figuring out how to do it through social policy. Something that we can do a little bit more about is the peer group influences, particularly in school. So, again, having integrated schools where kids are exposed to a broader cross-range of peer group influences, where they're kids who are from neighborhoods that are isolated from the mainstream economy, and people like William Julius Wilson write compellingly about this, some neighborhoods where almost no one has a steady job in the mainstream economy, everyone's in the gray market, everyone's kind of doing catch-as-catch-can. And so the kids don't have the kind of examples of the work ethic that kids from middle-class backgrounds take for granted, that some of that could be overcome through improved peer group influences in integrated schools. But you're right to say that the problem of broken homes and difficult home environments is a severe problem, and it's one that we should try to address as much as we can.
Just one thing, we have about maybe about 5 minutes left. I want to make sure that we get one further thing that you devote some time to discussing in the book, another one of these arenas in which the race card ends up being played. This is the clash of ends. And I guess here the question that I'm thinking about is, if indeed we're trying to use some social policy to correct the effects of past discrimination, is someone going to have to pay some price? And as a society, do we just simply have to say that's what's going to happen? And to those people who end up paying the price, we just say, well, sorry, but there's a greater good situation here, and that's just too bad?
In some cases, I'm afraid so. Now, what's important, and one of the point I try to make in the Clash of Ends, is that we need to have more agreement about what the goal is. It's very difficult to formulate public policy and to convince people that sacrifices are necessary if there's a lot of disagreement about the goal. At one time, a goal like integration was widely accepted as an appropriate goal for civil rights. And I think one of the things that most people accepted went along with integration was some assimilation to mainstream norms and some creation of a kind of a common civic culture. There's a language in Brown versus Board of Education about that. Now, that goal has been contested not only by the right, but also by the left. And one of the problems I had with the diversity rationale is that the kind of multiculturalism, the version of multiculturalism that says we're against assimilation, each group has its own distinctive culture and we don't want to come together, that's the antithesis of the ideal of Brown versus Board of Education, and it's something that throws into doubt the rationale of integration. And if no one can agree on the goal, then it's hard to make the case for sacrifices. In terms of sacrifices, I think that any number of people do, and we often ask people to make sacrifices for the greater good. So in the context of something like affirmative action, yes, it does mean that there are some people who might have otherwise been admitted to the college of their choice that won't be because we have an integrationist goal that leads to other children having, or other students having preferences. But that's not all that different than a lot of other preferences that colleges promote. But it is a sacrifice, and I think we have to acknowledge that. Let's take another example that we mentioned before, the racial profiling. There's an example in which we might say, because the law enforcement goal is sufficiently important, we're going to ask people to make sacrifices in terms of being stopped by police when they're innocent. If there's a racial profile that includes African American men between the ages of 30 and 40, I'm likely to be stopped, innocent of whatever offense the police are looking for. That's a sacrifice that society would be asking me to for the broader goal. And sometimes we do need to make those sacrifices.
Just real quick, in a sense, to take a step back, I'm interested. We were talking a little bit earlier about the example of dealing with this question of groups that have felt that they were the subject of discrimination. And we talked a little bit about the example of a person who felt discrimination based on their size. If we're going to say that we acknowledge that there are groups that have indeed faced discrimination and that we need to address this in law, and then that means that we have to make some decisions about who constitutes a group that can say we are a group and we have been discriminated against and we need to address it. Question is, I'm not stating it very elegantly, but the question is, okay, where do we draw the line between saying you person A, you have grounds for making a claim that your civil rights have been denied you, but you person B don't?
Right. Good, great question. It's a difficult question to answer, but I think we can begin with two things. One is history, and the other is the pervasiveness or the systematic nature of the discrimination. So first, to history, it's not an accident that Congress, when it passed the Civil Rights Act, chose the groups that it did, or the categories of unlawful discrimination. We've had a history in the United States of explicit state-sponsored race discrimination of a whole range of kinds, and that history demands some response. Same with sex discrimination. Religion, obviously, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well, much social strife and, indeed, bloody wars have been fought over the question of religious freedom. So it's appropriate to try to prevent that kind of discord in society. So there are good policy reasons for those types of groups. When you looked at the question of physical disabilities, Congress found that discrimination against the disabled was pervasive, so pervasive, in fact, that the overwhelming majority of people with disabilities lived below the poverty line, didn't have regular employment. So it was pervasive. Again, staying with race, pervasive discrimination that affects entire communities. So when someone faces race discrimination, it's not just them, and it's not just once. It would be repeatedly job after job after job, and not just them, but everybody and their family and everybody in the segregated neighborhood where they live. And so that's a real severe social problem that threatens to create a caste society. And threatens all manner of not only inequality, but also social discord and potentially violence. Some of the other cases, like weight discrimination, you don't fall into those two categories. There hasn't been any history of explicit discrimination on the basis of weight. There's no set of anti-weight ideologies that are entrenched in society. The world's never seen a segregated ghetto populated by fat people, nor has it seen a weight riot. And so in those senses, although the discrimination may be unfair, and I don't want to suggest that there's no problem there, because in many instances there is, at the same time, it's not the type of social problem that we see with things like race discrimination and sex discrimination and disability. And I would add sexual orientation, which is a category that I would like to see included in civil rights legislation.
We're at the point we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have one caller here that we can't take. Just as a way of finishing up, I guess I feel like going back to where it was that we started, where we talked about the fact that, yes, racism exists, and most people agree that it's there and that it's a problem. At the same time, then the thing that perhaps puts us in a difficult position is that while at the same time we'd say, yes, there is racism, yes, it is a problem, we can also say that there has been improvement in race relations. So, but that creates it just makes it difficult for us to figure out where exactly we are now, how we address issues of race, how we even talk about issues of race.
I think that's right. And, right now we tend to talk about issues of race in the context of scandal. So, it's Don Imus saying something ignorant about the Rutgers basketball, or it's Jeremiah Wright's speeches. These kind of spectacular scandals that don't really tell us very much about the real underlying racial problems that have yet to be addressed. So I think people are anxious to talk about race in a sense, but we don't have a very good way of talking about the real problems. So we talk about kind of phony race scandals instead.
Well, I think there we will finish up with our thanks to our guest, Richard Thompson Ford. He's professor of law at Stanford, and the book, if you'd like to read it, is The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. It's recently published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux. And Professor Ford, thank you very much.
Thank you.